From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, is it better to stay home and collect unemployment when the government check is more than you'd get at work?
I understand the argument. I understand it from a theoretical standpoint. But the truth of the matter is, for the majority of people, that's not the case.
Also today, why COVID might be the final nail in the coffin for the white tablecloth fine dining experience. And one restaurateur who's worked in many kinds of kitchens talks about how the ups and downs of the business prepared her for the pandemic.
Like, no matter how prepared you are, no matter how organized, there are going to be surprises that come up. So just really like staying calm and focused. You kind of have to learn how to stay calm under duress anyway.
Plus, teens talk to us about vaping and why people still do it despite the risks. It's another listen from the Michigan Radio podcast, Kids These Days. Those stories plus the elusive Windsor hum coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. You probably know already that there are serious consequences to vaping. Why is it that so many teens continue to do it? We'll be talking to teens about addiction later in the hour. Stay with us for that. But first, the clock is ticking on unemployment benefits. If you're in between jobs and you already know this, stay with us. But some may not be aware that states provide most of the unemployment benefits that are sustaining those out of a job during the pandemic slowdown. But the federal government has also been kicking in $600 a month in extra cash. Now that provision is supposed to sunset, Senate Republicans have developed a proposal for COVID stimulus that would reduce unemployment benefits from the federal government from $600 a week to $200 a week. Democrats in the House have said that's a non-starter for them. Joining us today is Representative Dan Kildee. He's a Democrat representing Michigan's 5th Congressional District. Congressman Kildee, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me on.
Can you lay out for us what is in the House Democrats' plan for the future of unemployment benefits over the near term?
Sure. Well, you know, we passed our legislation over 2 months ago to extend the unemployment benefits. In fact, it was my legislation that was included in the HEROES Act, which extends unemployment through January. Our sense was that if it was a good idea a few months ago at the beginning of this crisis to make sure that people had the financial resources they need if they lost their job in order to follow the medical advice that they're being given, it's a good idea then, it's a good idea now. We still have tens of millions of Americans unemployed with no real prospect of going back to work. And that unemployment benefit has not only been good for those families, it's been good for the whole economy. It has helped keep our economy afloat. It's helped others from not losing their jobs because of the loss of the demand in the economy that would result from taking away those benefits. So, you know, we passed our bill and we've just been waiting and waiting and waiting for the Senate to do something, and they still haven't. So, you know, we're ready to work with them, but we have to work from something.
Some of us know people, and the president has really leaned in on this point, who are collecting more in their unemployment benefits in this moment than they would if they were to return to work. And Republicans have argued that that setup may keep people tied in unemployment, even as conditions are evolving with COVID. How do you address that argument that it may be more profitable for some people to stay home in this moment?
Well, I understand the argument. I understand it from a theoretical standpoint. But the truth of the matter is, for the majority of people, that's not the case. And there is a reason that we decided on a flat rate benefit at $600, which was supported by virtually every Democrat and every Republican when we first voted for it. And the reason was that we knew it would be impossible, given the volume of cases, to go to what's called replacement rate unemployment benefits, where an individual calculation for each person who's unemployed would have to be made by the unemployment agency in order to get them the benefit that equals their pay.
My understanding, though, is that that's difficult for the states to put into effect. Have you heard anything from Governor Whitmer about that?
Yeah, from our understanding, and this is talking not only to Governor Whitmer's team, but to unemployment agency directors from around the country, is that it would take about 3 months to implement. And so, you know, for somebody who's wealthy, who can afford to carry that as a receivable, I'd say, wait 3 months to get your money. Well, you can't wait 3 months to eat. You can't wait 3 months to pay your rent. You can't wait 3 months to take care of your kids. You can't wait 3 months to pay the water bill. So why would we make you wait 3 months to get your unemployment benefit? Just because it's possible that somebody making unemployment would be getting slightly more than they got if they were working. You know, I find it somewhat offensive that some of the greatest critics of this are people who have orchestrated tax legislation that has allowed companies to game the tax system to massively increase their profits, to get far more than they otherwise would have. But they're somehow offended if somebody's getting $90 more a week than they were getting when they were on the job. And it's a small minority of the people who are unemployed. So, you know, the outrage that the opponents of this are expressing is a little hard to take when you think about the economic policies that they have ushered in.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about education matters. We are running headlong into a Michigan school year with a pretty piecemeal approach across the board. And we've been speaking with educators both up north and in southern parts of Michigan that are more densely populated. Do you feel at this point this is just a reality of the pandemic, that every region is going to have to do what's safe in their area? Or do you see this as a problem with leadership and maybe a lack of support for school districts?
Well, I think it's a combination. Number one, we should make the decisions that are based on good science. If the science tells us that we would put children and families at risk of spreading the disease by having a full return to school, well, then we shouldn't do it. We can always make up for the time that these kids might lose. We can come up with other ways of getting them educational experiences through the virtual platforms that are available. But you can't bring somebody back to life who gets sick and dies as a result of exposure. We just have to accept the fact that there's no one to blame. This is a tough time. You know, I wish the federal government had done a better job, but the virus is going to do what it's going to do. We can't wish it away or tweet it away. We have to address it head on using good science. And if that science says, let's not have large gatherings, we shouldn't. And that includes school children. If the president is so concerned about bringing people together that he cancels his own precious Republican National Convention, for goodness sakes, he can't very well argue that children and teachers should put themselves at risk because he wants to get them back to school. You know what? If it's too dangerous for him, it's too dangerous for them.
Right now, 2/3 of the K-12 emergency funding in the relief bill that Senate Republicans have put forth would be reserved for schools that are physically reopening and doing some kind of in-person instruction. How firm do you think that is?
It's hard to say because with the president and with the Senate Republicans, it's not clear what their ultimate position might be. I think in some cases, you know, he may be just trying to make a point. But look, I think local school districts and local school boards, along with their state departments of education, are in the best position to decide what the safe thing to do would be. And I don't think the federal government should try to create incentives for school districts to make decisions that are not based on the health of the people that they serve. They should make a decision based on the health needs of the community. And the federal government ought not punish them because they make a decision that ultimately could save lives and that they perceive to be in the best interest of that particular community.
Do you think that there is some possibility for the federal government to act right now on behalf of parents? There's some real fear now from parents who feel like they're standing on shifting sands with respect to their kids' school year. We just talked to an educator from up north who said that she's got concerns about kids being left at home alone, smaller kids. Is it appropriate for the federal government to make some response in situations where families are struggling to juggle work and being teachers at home?
Yeah, I think it's not only appropriate, I think it's necessary. You know, some months ago, the president said that he feels like he's a wartime president. well, if we're going to fight this war against this virus, we need to use every tool that we have available to do it. And, you know, this is how the federal government protects its citizens. We have an obligation to protect them. If that means additional support for smaller group childcare, for example, which is something that we're voting on today, we should do that. If it means providing direct support to school districts to support distance learning, we should do that. If it means making sure that those families aren't forced to choose between taking care of their families safely or trying to support them by finding work outside of the home, we ought to give them that choice. You know, the unemployment benefit, like I said, and this is really central to this whole issue, the unemployment benefit is intended to keep these families afloat and keep the U.S. economy from collapsing. And I think that's fundamentally what has to happen. In order for a family to not lose everything that they've worked for, they've got to be able to pay their bills. And I think that is sort of the fundamental first obligation we have in a crisis, in a war, to make sure that we don't put people at unnecessary risk.
I know it feels like we've been in triage mode since March, but have you given thought to how long we as Americans will be paying for the stimulus that's being racked up at this time?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reality that we face is that we're going to be paying for it for a while. We will pay for it if we get this wrong and we don't support families and businesses and the economy and we go into an economic collapse. That's the worst case scenario, because not only will there be a lot of immediate economic harm, but the United States financial situation will be much worse if we allow that to happen. There is not a choice that says this doesn't come with a high cost. The question is, how do we want to pay for it? Do we want to pay for it by supporting families, or do we want to pay for it by allowing those families to lose everything and pay in a way that's not just financial, but has long-term implications, generational poverty, for example? So I think we have no choice that does not come with a high cost.
Dan Kildee represents Michigan's 5th Congressional District. Congressman, we've got to go, but thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Up next, there are a lot of things that may or may not survive the global pandemic that's going on right now. Among them, fine dining.
Caviar and blinis don't necessarily translate well to carry out packaging.
We'll talk about what's going on in the restaurant business after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We wanted to update you on one of the stories that we've been following lately. You might remember on Monday, we kicked off conversations about systemic racism in the arts, and we talked with a couple of curators who'd worked on fellowships at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, that's MOCAD, and they told us about conversations and situations they had there that, as people of color, they found were abusive. Today, MOCAD's board has terminated the executive director, Alicia Barrowy-Reeder. You can listen to Monday's episode as part of our podcast feed if you want to get the backstory on this. And stay tuned later in the week. We're going to have more on the story, and we'll also speak with administrators and other professionals about the moment of recognition for a long-standing equity problem in the arts. Celebrate silence. That is exactly what folks on the south side of the Detroit River in Windsor, Ontario, have been doing. What you're listening to right now is an audio-enhanced recording of the infamous and somewhat mysterious Windsor Hum. Residents on the west side of Windsor has been dealing with this unexplained phenomenon for nearly a decade. Here's Windsor resident Mike Provost describing the hum to Stateside back in 2016.
Well, we have the hum, which can be two different things depending on where you live and what you're hearing, because it seems to be the truck idling next to your house for a lot of people. And some people hear it as a pulsing and a pounding against the side of your house. It is constant. It sounds like thunder. Let's call it thunder, but we know it's not thunder. Boom, 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 boom. And that goes on for minutes, hours, days without a break.
with no clear explanation, conspiracy theories abounded, from secret government programs to aliens. However, it seems like what most people thought was the culprit is correct. It's the U.S. steel plant on Zug Island. Work at the plant has slowly come to an end since this spring. However, that does not mean that the Windsor Hum is gone forever. If the plant should reopen, the Hum will return. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Over the past few months, we've talked to a number of restaurant owners about how the pandemic has affected their business. Many have been struggling with the financial curveball and the need to keep putting paychecks into staff pockets. Some are making dramatic changes to their brand and service model, switching from upscale offerings to comfort carryout food in order to get through. But we wanted to take a second look at what COVID has meant for white tablecloth restaurants, where food itself is maybe one piece of a multi-part overall experience. Joining us now to talk about the future of fine dining is Mark Kurlianchik, restaurant critic for the Detroit Free Press. Mark, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, April.
Just so we're all on the same page, could you start out by explaining what you mean when we talk about fine dining?
Yeah, to me, fine dining has some old school connotations, white tablecloths, servers who are typically in wearing some kind of server's uniform, no jeans. I think our sort of idea of fine dining has shifted kind of since the recession. And now we may equate some places that are still kind of upscale and serving food at a high level as fine dining. But I think that that's kind of more of a, we've seen this kind of growth of fine casual food in the last decade. And fine dining there was predictions that it was going to come back, this sort of staid white tablecloth, very formal service. And I think COVID has sort of put what may be the final nail in the coffin of that kind of old school dining experience.
Oh, wow. Have you heard from any restaurateurs about how fine dining establishments are doing? Or are you aware of any that have opened back up?
Yeah, so there's a really interesting case in Birmingham. There's a place called Pernoy, and Pernoy was opened by two of the most well-known chefs in Michigan dining of the last 30 years, Luciano Del Signore of Bacco Restaurant in Southfield, and Takashi Yagahashi, who was on board early on. And Takashi is known here for Tribute, which was sort of one of the pinnacles of fine dining in Detroit history, or in Metro Detroit history, period. And they teamed up late last year to open up Pernoy, which was supposed to be the super high end. They were going for, basically like a 3 Michelin star experience, white tablecloths. I mean, you had food that was served at the exact same time, for a table of multiple diners, just kind of everything that you think of the classic fine dining experience. They even initially started off by requiring jackets for men in the dining room, which is sort of a really old school approach.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it's been really interesting to watch Pernoy shift, because that jacket requirement was actually dropped pretty early on, well before COVID. So I think, that was an early indicator of how, how the general population feels about these old school sort of rituals. And then, Takashi ended up leaving, actually. It just wasn't working out. He actually lives in Chicago and has multiple fast casual concepts in Chicago. Then COVID hit and they switched to carryout, and, caviar and blinis don't necessarily translate well to carryout packaging. And so they switched the concept to be this trattoria style. So kind of red sauce Italian classics almost, like things that your Italian grandmother would cook for you.
Yeah.
Veal parm and whatnot. And that did very well for them, when dining rooms were shut down across the state. And so they stuck with it when they reopened. Instead of going back to this super high-end experience, they're now, it's now Casa Pernoy, which, it's basically home-style Italian. I mean, it's still very much upscale, and it's, you can drop a penny there without trying too hard, but it's certainly not near the level of what it was before. And so, that's kind of a very potent example of the casualization of a place that was really trying to kind of bring back this classic fine dining experience that's now just completely pivoted to kind of adapt to the new realities.
What do you think people want from fine dining other than gourmet food. I feel like the experiences that I've had in, you know, were like occasion moments where, you know, it was a moment for celebration, maybe for family. But what else do you see? What else do you see people turning to fine dining for? And is that need still alive?
Yeah, I mean, this is where things get really interesting, because to me, you know, a fine dining meal, what it really provides is escape, right? Or a suspension of reality, where you kind of just forget about all your troubles and you're doted on hand and foot for every small little need that you have. And I think that's where the real challenge for fine dining lies going forward, is how do you suspend reality? How do you provide a form of escape when your staff have to be wearing PPE and are limiting their interactions? I mean, it's a constant sort of reminder, you know, even seeing a server in a face mask is a sort of constant reminder of the pandemic that's raging outside those doors. Or, you know, I guess the challenge is that it may be inside the doors too, and we can't see it.
And it feels like health officials would say that level of mindfulness is necessary right now. You know, I don't know that this is something that has been formally, you know, said in terms of dining, but that we all kind of have to be more aware of our surroundings than we used to be to stay safe.
Right. And you know, the other thing with fine dining is it really requires a lot of labor. So a lot of people in a small confined area, right? I mean, for some of these places, you're talking about three servers just in the front of house that are taking care of each guest. You know, you have sort of your waiter, your back waiter. Sometimes you have like a captain, a service captain, typically multiple touches at the table, multiple people taking care of you. And if we're talking about limiting, you know, the way that we interact with one another and limiting the amount of people that we interact with, there's just no reality that sort of old school fine dining can work with this pandemic.
Yeah. So as you've been thinking this through, what do you think fine dining as we know it look like in this current moment, assuming that some restaurants are able to stay open with physical distancing? What could fine dining look like right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are some benefits that the model does offer operators, namely an ability to control costs. So, you know, if you know that you are serving, you know, 50 prefix menus and it's just what is on the menu is what you're serving, and you maybe you take payment in advance, like a lot of those sort of higher end restaurants have been doing, where you pay for your entire meal up front, almost like a concert ticket. You know, the operator knows that they have 50 reservations that night and everybody is having the same menu, so they can really plan for the amount of food that they need. So there's less waste in that regard, and then they can, you know, really have control of their numbers. Whereas if you have 50 reservations in a more casual environment, you don't know what they're going to order, how many things. It's, you know, things get wasted, things have to get used up. So there's a level of control that fine dining offers, which I think we may see more restaurants that were sort of in this fine casual mode that maybe even didn't take reservations. You know, they were walk-in only because they're so busy. Switching to more of this sort of prefix or a more predictable sort of menu where you can book your experience in advance or at least have a reservation. I guess it also does help that, you know, communal tables are not really a thing at fine dining establishments. Shared plates are not really a thing at fine dining establishments. You know, is it possible that there is a future for fine dining? Sure. I mean, I don't think it's going to go away completely, but it's going to be more of a struggle to really give that sort of escapist environment, right? That escapist experience. And I think that the X factor is how comfortable are people going to be, the general public going to be, wanting to go to a place and sit for 3 hours or 4 hours for this long multi-course meal in an enclosed environment. So many challenges, and, you know, just in this one sort of niche in restaurants. But I mean, those challenges, it doesn't matter what kind of restaurant you are, you know, you're challenged right now.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the future of fine dining in Michigan during the COVID era with Detroit Free Press restaurant critic Mark Kurlianchik. What are the risks for the frontline workers who go back to work in fine dining? Do you see them as being essentially different than what other restaurant workers are dealing with right now?
I wouldn't say not essentially. I mean, the restaurant industry as a whole generally does a pretty poor job of taking care of its frontline workers, and that, you know, your pay range in the front of house in a fine dining establishment is certainly a little bit higher than it would be elsewhere. You know, you can make $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, upwards of $100,000 as a server in some very high-end fine dining restaurants. At 50% capacity, you're going to see those, you know, folks who are maybe supporting a full family on a salary like that, you know, not be able to do that anymore. So I think staffing is going to be a big issue. Do I think that the challenges necessarily are different, that safety challenges are different? Not necessarily, because you're still serving the public, and you just, as a server or somebody working in the front of house at a restaurant, there's no way that you can vet every single person that walks through your door. You know, even if they make the reservations in advance, you just don't know what those people are doing. The safety issue is an issue that doesn't matter what type of restaurant you're in, you're going to be exposed to at some level to a form of risk, because there's going to be people that once they're seated at your table can take their masks off and are now breathing the same air as you.
You know, Mark, a listener pointed out to us that there have been a couple of social media posts from Michigan restaurants that sort of wink at their customer base, saying, if you are not wearing masks, we'll assume that you're medically unable. Have you heard anything from restaurant owners about, you know, I don't know if they'd be very forthcoming if they were playing it fast and loose with the rules, but aren't there legal requirements now under Governor Whitmer's orders that masks aren't really optional?
Well, yes, there are, but there is still the caveat that, you know, you cannot wear a mask for certain medical conditions. And because of HIPAA laws and privacy thing, you know, it's very hard as a business owner, it doesn't matter what type of business you have, to be able to determine whether that person who is not wearing a mask or refusing to wear a mask actually has a medical condition or not. So the climate right now in restaurants is not like anything I've ever seen before. And I mean, it's not just restaurants, it's in all businesses, but just the tension, the unease, I mean, the all the additional stressors that are being placed on, you know, operators, frontline employees, back of house employees, you know, now as an owner, as a manager at a restaurant, you are now a contact tracer. You are now, you know, sort of a physician because you're running health checks on your staff. Mm. It's just all these additional things that we're asking of restaurants who, you know, generally already have to do a lot of sanitary things, but now there's all these new sort of tensions that can touch points with customers that can fall on one end or another of the spectrum on mask wearing, you know, and so much of it is politicized that it's just, you know, we even have reports of some restaurants choosing to shut down rather than be, you know, mask enforcers. There's a place in Dearborn Heights, a Mexican restaurant, that they were open for 2 weeks, and after 2 weeks said, you know what, enough of this. Until this is over, we're not opening because we cannot, you know, this is just too much to ask of our staff and too much for us to handle.
I saw that post. It said that staff members had been treated rudely on a number of occasions, and they just weren't going to do it. They weren't going to put their staff in that policing position. It sounds like we're in a place where there isn't a real obvious mechanism for enforcement.
Well, that's the issue. I mean, you know, a lot of this has been self-policing, right? And the enforcement has been lax. I mean, a lot of this enforcement actually doesn't fall on the local health departments, you know, for mask wearing and PPE and such. It falls on my OSHA. And my OSHA, you know, has, I don't know, I actually don't know the number and I don't want to quote it because I don't want to be wrong, but very few folks dedicated to enforcement, particularly in restaurants, you know, of the thousands of restaurants in the state of Michigan, there may just be a handful of my OSHA folks doing, you know, who are tasked with certainly enforcement. I mean, there have been threats as well from Attorney General Dana Nessel to revoke liquor license laws if there are businesses or restaurants or bars that are shown as not taking these guidelines seriously. But to date, I don't know of a single establishment that's gotten its liquor license revoked, you know, for that reason.
This is just a lot. Have you heard about many fine dining restaurants that have just said, that's it, we're closing our doors permanently?
You know, not yet. I think there's still a bit of a wait and see. I know it's hard to believe that, you know, basically the fifth month into this pandemic, we're still taking a wait and see approach. But there's still so much uncertainty that and a lot of places have been slow to reopen. So I have not heard of any place saying, no, you know, we're just not going to open. You know, Pernod was one that they, instead of reopening in their former self, they sort of, you know, remodeled to fit this new reality. But I think we'll see over the next few months, particularly as cases spike and there's the threat of another shutdown, we'll see some more permanent, you know, decisions on the part of restaurants in general. I think up to this point, the PPP loans have maybe helped keep some of the places, keep their doors open. But there's also plenty of folks that just haven't reopened yet. And I think that, you know, many of them would probably like to go as quietly as they possibly can. And you know, the sad thing is that a lot of this is by no doing of their own. It's just, you know, it's a business model that needs to be adjusted for this new reality.
Mark Kurlianchik is restaurant critic for the Detroit Free Press. Mark, thanks so much for your work, and please do stay safe.
Thank you so much, April.
In just a minute, we're going to go a little bit further into the future of fine dining with someone who certainly knows, restaurateur Eve Aronoff-Fernandez.
Like, no matter how prepared you are, no matter how organized, there are going to be surprises that come up. You kind of have to learn how to stay calm under duress.
Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Just a minute ago, we were talking with Mark Kurlianchik, who covers restaurants in Metro Detroit. If you were a restaurant owner, what would you do right now? Would you take your chances with table service? Maybe try to pivot into something doable and distanced? It seems like the ground is shifting beneath business owners' feet every day. Eve Aronoff-Fernandez is a restaurateur extraordinaire. She is currently the owner and chef at Frida Batidos, the fast-casual Cuban phenom with locations in Ann Arbor and Detroit. But she's had all kinds of roles in the industry. She ran the upscale eatery Eve, was a contestant on Top Chef, attended Le Cordon Bleu in Paris. Once she even sold hot dogs at Fenway Park. And she is actually expanding Frida Batidos during the pandemic. Eve Aronoff-Fernandez, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Hey, for those who haven't had the pleasure, can you describe what the atmosphere is normally like, I guess, before COVID-19?
Like, one of the things that's most important to us is to kind of foster the spirit of conviviality. It's a tenet from the slow food movement, and it's something that just means a lot to us, just to welcome people to sit together and just enjoy themselves around food. So it's usually just like a really warm, convivial, bustling environment.
What services is Frida offering right now? There's carryout for sure, and also patio service, right?
There is. There's carryout, delivery, which is new for us, and then the patio service, which has been expanded. So we're fortunately have a larger patio space.
You've expanded Frida Batidos into the space next door, which was previously occupied by the restaurant Logan, which sadly closed last month.
Yeah.
What went into your decision to take this on? That sounds like it might feel pretty risky right now.
It just was an opportunity that came up, and it was very bittersweet, like as you mentioned, with our neighbors closing. But we've needed space for a long time, and you know, we've never had a door to the back alley. We've never had some basic things that most restaurants have, just for deliveries and things like that. And now it just seems so much more important because of the need for social, like, distancing. So we felt like we just kind of had to make it work and just figure out how to make it work.
Socially distant dining options.
Yes. Because right now the dining room still isn't open at Frida because we just didn't feel comfortable with it, with our space.
It seems like restaurateurs are having to juggle so many things as they decide how far to go in reopening, like what price points will work. What has it been like making these decisions about what to move forward on and what's going to have to wait?
Well, we've just kind of tried to just kind of have the benefits of what restaurant life already prepares you for. Just like, no matter how prepared you are, no matter how organized, there are going to be surprises that come up. So just really like staying calm and focused. you kind of have to learn how to stay calm under duress anyway. So just trying to like use those things and just brainstorm together as a group. We have an amazing group of staff and managers that we've worked together with for almost 16 years. So just really like trying to talk through things together and have regular meetings with the staff at a safe distance so we can make good decisions together.
You've had, as I mentioned, so many different kinds of experiences in the industry. What do you see as the biggest challenges facing service industry right now?
I mean, I think just balancing the need to like, you know, you need and want to stay in business, but you also, it's important in a different level to keep the staff safe, and the staff is generally in a restaurant like family. And then the community, you know, we care so much about the community. So keeping the guests that come in safe while you keep the business as strong as humanly possible. So just balancing those things.
Is there anything that you've learned from either the successes or the less successful things that have happened in the various businesses that you've started that's particularly useful right now?
I mean, for me, I think the thing that's been the most helpful is just kind of working together and communicating as a community within the restaurant. You know, when I started, I kind of just felt like I needed to make every decision myself and just, you know, I'm so involved in every aspect, but really like listening to each other and figuring things out because, you know, somebody else will inevitably have thought of something you haven't thought of. So just brainstorming as a group has like really gotten us through this. And right. It's just very different from the way I have approached things when I started.
You know, I wonder if the challenges, you know, facing any restaurant depend on the business models. Having seen this from a couple different levels, how do you see challenges being different right now for, say, a white tablecloth fine dining business compared with someplace more casual?
Well, a lot of it is about space now, you know, and just how many people can safely fit in the space, you know, and be comfortable and you know, make sure that all comes together to work. So we, you know, thought about all the different options when the Logan space became available. Should we make that Eve? Should we open up as a pop-up for Eve? That was our first restaurant for 6 months. And it's, you know, every restaurant, every business has to take different things into account. But, you know, there's obviously like a higher ticket average for a more formal restaurant, but fewer guests, you know, per service period. So it's really just like balancing those things out. And for us, it was a really amazing opportunity to have the Logan space so we could continue with Frida, you know, in a way that felt safe and comfortable for everybody.
Eve Aronoff Fernandez is the proprietor of Frida Batidos with locations in Ann Arbor and Detroit. Eve, it's a real pleasure talking to you. We hope you and your team can stay safe and hopefully open.
Thank you kindly. Appreciate it.
If you walk into a high school bathroom, go for a drive, go to a party, it's pretty much guaranteed somebody is going to have a vape or an e-cigarette. In the latest episode of Michigan Radio's podcast, Kids These Days, students from Community High School in Ann Arbor ask, what do you sign up for when you hit a Juul for the first time? And why is it that so many teens keep on vaping, even though they know that there can be serious consequences? Let's listen.
All three teens in our story started vaping for pretty much the same reasons.
I would never have gotten into it if my friends weren't doing it.
This is Daniel. He's 17 years old, pretty popular, super athletic, and he loves to sail, swim, and run.
It's just kind of something you can do when you're just like hanging out, watching a movie. Like, it's not like, oh, let's go vape. It's like, let's go drive around and you just end up vaping.
It's everywhere. It's literally everywhere.
Lily's also in high school. She's 17 years old. The first time she vaped was in eighth grade, but she was just doing it for the flavors. She thought it was dumb. But by sophomore year, Soarin' Drops, these little, easy-to-hide vapes shaped like teardrops, were becoming super popular, and all her friends had one.
Once everybody started getting them, like, it just became so normal. Like, I was like, oh, if everybody's gonna, like, mess up their life doing that, then, like, I might as well, too, you know? Like,
that's how another teen, Kat, got hooked, too. Soarin' Drops. She liked all the colors that they came in.
It was much more about like the way it looked than the way it made me feel.
Kat's a big theater kid. She loves to sing. And just like Lily and Daniel, Kat started vaping because her friends were doing it. They used Soren Airs, then Juuls. And something to know about these vape companies, they're notorious for how aggressively they market themselves to teenagers. Even the way they name their flavors to get kids to use them, like Blue Razz Lemonade and Strawberry Watermelon.
And we've seen this type of thing before with cigarettes and how tobacco companies aggressively marketed their products.
What could be more refreshing than Newport Menthol cigarettes?
Vapes were supposed to be the answer to cigarettes, to help wean people off of their addiction. But now, younger people are starting with and getting addicted to their vapes. And if one person in the group has a vape, they're probably going to share it, especially in a school bathroom.
Like, it was just such a social thing. Like, it was like a big thing to bring people together. It was like, oh, can I hit your nick?
But there were some other factors, too. Kat was in a pretty toxic relationship, and she missed her sister who had recently moved away to college. Also, someone in her grade had passed away who was close to Kat and many others, and it really took a toll on her and her classmates emotionally.
And that kind of made everyone start getting dependent on, like, substances like weed and, like, drinking way more. Like, we kind of were taking things slow, and then all of a sudden, our grade just went crazy.
Kat used vaping to cope with some of the things that were going on in her life. She used it mostly when she was just hanging out, and eventually, it became a routine.
Like Kat, Daniel mostly vaped when he was just hanging out. He had a knee injury that took him away from playing sports, which gave him a lot of free time.
And I just kind of got pulled into it because I would just do it with my friends because that's how I filled my time. I'd just be with my friends all the time.
The thing is, what can start as an innocent hit here and there can lead to a full-blown nicotine addiction, like it did for Lily.
The first time that I used it and felt like I needed it afterwards was when I was hanging out with this group of people and we spent the whole night just like passing like vapes around. And like the next day after that, I was like fiending for it.
She started to really crave the taste, and seeing a video of someone vaping or smelling a cigarette could trigger FOMO.
I just feel like I belong to my addiction. Like I feel like I just, I don't know, if it's around me, I have to do it.
So for a lot of teens, that's how nicotine addictions start. Your friends do it, so you do it. And once you're addicted, you develop a codependency on your vape. Now we want to tell you about the different ways these three addictions play out. Let's start with Kat.
When we left her, she had hit rock bottom. Only she didn't know it.
It would be like 5 hours and I wouldn't hit it. And I'd be like, I need to hit it. And then it would be like 3 hours, and then 1 hour, and then like 30 minutes.
Her teachers did, though, and so did her parents. They eventually convinced her to go to an outpatient program.
That, like, completely flipped a switch in my brain about addiction in general, but, like, specifically for nicotine.
Kat went to the outpatient program for 3 weeks and stayed home from school. She realized that she needed the help that she was getting. The program involved a lot of group therapy, and it really changed her outlook on life. It made her way more honest with herself.
It's not easy, and just because you quit once doesn't mean you're going to quit forever. And, like, you have to know that, because if you don't, then you're just going to feel so, like, mad. It's kind of unreasonable to expect someone to be able to quit and never go back to it.
Going back to vaping is so easy when the people around you are constantly doing it. Surrounding yourself with people who don't vape is much easier said than done, but Kat has some tips.
Like, I definitely would say, like, my mental health is so much better when I'm not vaping. Like, when I don't have anything to rely on, like, that's, like, a substance like that, like, I just feel better about myself. And I feel like if you just keep reminding yourself that, eventually you'll realize how much better you are.
She's able to stay away from vaping by being confident in the fact that she's better off without it. But Daniel didn't get that chance to hit rock bottom and climb back up again. One minute, Daniel, the injured athlete, was just passing time, vaping with his friends in the car, hanging out. The next,
I felt like I couldn't breathe, and that was what sent me to the ER.
The doctors had no clue as to what was going on. The x-ray of Daniel's chest showed that nothing was wrong. He was told he was just a typical anxious kid having a panic attack.
But then I woke up 1 month later, and I had received a double lung transplant.
A double lung transplant. The doctors aren't sure if what caused it was the nicotine or THC in the vapes that he had used. The chemicals in pods and cartridges affect people's bodies in different ways. What might be harmless for one person can be catastrophic for another. But what we do know is that the doctors think it's all vaping related.
I'll see the scar on my chest and I'll just be like, wow, like, this is like insane. That this, like, how is this even my life? Like, it's still so crazy that like each breath I take right now is through someone else's lungs.
Daniel's life can never be the same after this. He has to take about 20 pills a day to keep his body from rejecting the transplanted lungs, and he will for the rest of his life.
He also faced huge physical changes during his hospital stay. He weighed 150 pounds and was muscular when he walked in, but when he left, he weighed only 99. His muscles had atrophied, and he couldn't even walk on his own. And the whole thing has hurt Daniel's mental health as well.
Before, I was a kind of anxious kid, but now I have panic attacks like every day. I have nightmares. I've been diagnosed with PTSD. I have severe anxiety, some depression, like just all these changes coming in at once just were too much. And especially right now, the fact that I can't see my friends and that some of them are still vaping too, some of my close friends, it takes a toll on me.
Daniel has to be super cautious about his day-to-day activities, who he can hang out with, where he can go, and the amount of energy he can even exert on his body.
And people who haven't gone through the same experience as him think it could never happen to them.
A lot of people just don't care. Like, that's all I can really say about it. They do whatever they want that makes them feel good in the moment, and they don't really think about the future.
Thinking about the future is hard to do when you're just trying to fit in. And we ask Lily if she had known how serious her nicotine addiction would get when she started.
I mean, do you think you ever would have done it? I want to say no, but it's just so prevalent in, like, high school society that I probably would have anyway. Like, I knew about the risks, and, like, I did it anyway just because everyone else did it, and, like, it was so normalized. And, like, now, everybody who's younger than me or who doesn't vape, I'm like, I swear to God, if you ever start vaping, I will be so disappointed because it, like, it's really, like, taking control over my life and it sucks.
She cares about her health but just can't quit. She's tried 3 times. Twice she went cold turkey. But making that choice and sticking with it is super difficult.
That's definitely the hardest part, is just the accessibility, and people are always willing to, like, let you use it. And, like, it's hard to say no if somebody offers it. And also, like, it fills, like, gaps in social situations, too. Like, if you're awkward or, like, don't know what to say with somebody, like, sometimes you just, like, vape.
Vaping is such a normal part of high school life now that when you see someone juuling in the bathroom, you don't even think twice about it. Kat says that has to stop.
Like, majority of the kids I know vape, and, like, that's not normal, and we shouldn't have, like, normalized it, but we did so fast that, like, in a social setting, it's almost weird if you don't do it. It's not even almost weird. It is weird if you don't do it. And so I feel like going back to that, like, being weird to do it, like, even though people shouldn't be shamed for addiction, they shouldn't be encouraged to start one.
But here's the catch. A lot of teens probably aren't going to talk to their parents about it, and many teens don't want to ask for help from school, because schools make it clear that they'll get in trouble if they do.
Like, the schools make it really hard, because if you get caught vaping, you don't get told, like, oh, you need to go see a therapist. You get told, like, oh, you're going to get punished for 3 days. And what are they going to do on those 3 days? Probably vape. Like, just sit at home and do nothing and get more addicted.
Kat says instead, schools should provide addiction counselors or even send them to outpatient programs like the one she went to. She wishes that they encourage students to seek help instead of making them feel ashamed or scared. In our opinion, adults haven't really figured out how to help because they don't fully understand what it's like to be a teen addicted. Vaping is everywhere.
And it's also important to remember that there's not an average kid who vapes. Kat had to be shown that vaping was holding her back, and her parents and teachers gave her the chance to quit. Daniel didn't have that choice. It was made for him. And Lily is still battling her addiction.
You can download and subscribe to Kids These Days on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Funding for Michigan Radio's new podcast, Kids These Days, comes from the Michigan Health Endowment Fund, a philanthropic foundation working to improve the health of Michigan residents with a focus on the wellness of children and older adults. More at mihealthfund.org. Support also comes from the Children's Foundation, working to improve the health and well-being of children and their families with pediatric research, education, community benefit programs, and other initiatives. On the web at yourchildrensfoundation.org. That's it for Stateside today. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow.